Let me start my recorder. Let me apologize also. The recorder, the batteries, which indicated a full battery charge when I started, somehow gave out after 47 minutes of the first talk. So Nathan Hatch. And then I mentioned Bill Kavanaugh. The first book of his I ever read was called Being Consumed, Economics and Christian Desire. And if we have time, we're going to listen to a little bit of an interview I did with him about this. And particularly, the question he's asking, would Augustine regard free market economics as promoting anything recognizable as freedom in Augustinian terms? So when we is freedom understood in anything like biblical understanding when we talk about the free market? And then I've got three books by Oliver O'Donovan, who we're going to hear in a minute. Oliver O'Donovan, how many of you know O'Donovan's work? Not many. Oh, good. I get to introduce you to my favorite, probably my favorite philosopher, theologian. Years ago, I discovered a book he wrote in 84, 86, called Resurrection and Moral Order, which is subtitled An Outline for Evangelical Ethics. He was then Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Oxford. And it's basically asking the question, what makes Christian ethics Christian? And the answer is the resurrection. So how is the resurrection understood as a central ordering concept, ordering reality, not just a concept, an ordering reality for understanding the task of Christian ethics? And he's a demanding writer. Every sentence is carefully crafted and high potency, highly caffeinated. That is, in a sense, a preface to his book called The Desire of the Nations, Rediscovering the Roots of Political Theology, which came out 10 years later, 1996. And it's probably the most referred to book that I know of, anyway, if not objectively so, in recovering a deeply theologically informed understanding of politics. And basically asking the question of how do we parse out the consequences of the kingship of Christ? We say Christ is King of Kings. What does it have to do with politics? And how is God's rule evident in the rulers in the ruling of temporal authorities?
What's the name of the book?
The Desire of the Nations. And again, these are demanding books. Plan on spending a year or so to work through them. They're not going to get through them. But yeah, it's worth the time. It's worth the time. And you're going to hear him in a minute.
You're selling yourself short.
All you pastors do is read all the time anyway, right? And then a much easier little book. Look how thin this is, and look how widely spaced the letters are. These are three lectures that he gave at Calvin Seminary. The Staub lectures, Calvin College and Seminary. As long as Calvin's in there. Common Objects of Love, Moral Reflection, and the Shaping of Community. And these are based on three lectures he gave back in 2001. And it's a wonderful, wonderful excursion in understanding what forms a community. And again, Common Objects of Love is a phrase from Augustine. O'Donovan is one of a number of high-octane scholars who are recovering Augustinian ideas for political thought particularly. And I think it's an exciting time to be understanding these things. Before the Q&A, one last thing, an Oliver O'Donovan note. I'm going to play part of an interview I did with him 3 years ago in Washington. A friend of mine organized an event on Capitol Hill where O'Donovan and I and my friend were seated in front of about 160 congressional staffers and executive office workers talking about political theology for an hour and a half. And so I recently, Marcel Audio has launched a special series, given how dismal our political moment is, launched a special series, a weekly series we're doing on political theology. And the first one was with O'Donovan. And I sent him an email earlier this week to let him know we've done it. And he sent me back this note. He said, thanks for sending this, and he says some personal things. And then he made a remarkable observation that I've been thinking about since I got it. The astonishing political phenomenon in which your nation is currently caught up, he's British, is part, and this is, okay, we all know it, we're living through this Lewis Carroll surrealism here. But he says, the astonishing political phenomenon in which your nation is currently caught up is part of an international wave of similar phenomena, though they take different forms in different places. Now then, the next two sentences. The politicians identify the problem as a sense of discontent and political exclusion. And that's not just the politicians. A lot of analysts are saying, this is what makes Trump, this is what makes Bernie Sanders. People feel excluded. They're angry because they're excluded. That's how it's popularly identified. And then he says, Christians, comma, perhaps, comma. He inserts that, what I call the journalistic qualification. He's writing like a journalist. Christians, perhaps, have learned enough to read the problem as that of a moral unintelligibility which has befallen the institutions of Western government, a state of things for which the churches, too, must bear their share of blame. Our institution, Christians have perhaps learned enough to read the problem as that of a moral unintelligibility which has befallen the institutions of Western government, a state of things for which the churches too must bear their share of blame. So, and this is something that I mentioned in the script for the piece we're going to hear later tonight, that he argues in The Desire of the Nations that the whole idea of the legitimacy of political authority has evaporated, and he argues that the legitimacy of political authority is ultimately rooted in a religious claim. Either the God or the gods stand behind political authority. I mean, our coinage does say, in God we trust, we say one nation under God, so there's still some kind of allusion to that. But in fact, we believe that governments are created by the people, for the people, and of the people, and necessarily in that order. We think that governments are something we make rather than governments being actually God's servants for your good. Which, again, throughout human history, the idea that there's some kind of divine power that undergirds or overarches political and gives legitimacy to political authority has always been understood. East and West. I just did an interview with a historian who wrote this massive three-volume work on the history of the idea of divine kingship. And he's not talking about divine right of kings. That's a late, late development. But so at some level, there's this intuition that human beings have always had, that the intuition that's actually explained explicitly in the Psalms and in the Old Testament, that Yahweh rules and that Christ is the King of Kings. So all true valid political authority is a derived authority. It's a derivative and subsidiary authority. When that gets lost, one of the claims that he makes, when that is lost, it finally becomes morally unintelligible. And you'll hear more about that later. And that's why I think one of the roles that the church has in the coming years or generations is to recover and articulate clearly an understanding of the nature of political community and political authority that's incredibly unpopular. As he says in the interview, it's highly unfashionable to say this, but in fact it's true. It has the advantage of being true, and actually does establish a sense of moral intelligibility to political authority. So let's take 10 minutes or so to see what kinds of questions came up. And if you want to save those for tomorrow morning, that's fine also.
I guess, when I think about engaging rather than just winning the Princeton Teriology every Sunday, which is what I like anyway. Of course, that's a big thing. I don't know, making the arrow, but
right.
There's, yeah, it'd really be great if you could visit every church in America and everybody could understand what you're saying. It's really excellent. So when churches engage, we get this map going in 1,000 different directions. So how do we?
Yeah.
How does the church, capital C, do that?
Well. A friend of mine's getting ready to give a lecture in Charlottesville next year. He just sent me the title for it, called what is it? The Cultural Consequences of Christian Division, I think he calls it. I did an interview with a historian from Notre Dame last year, a book he wrote called Brad Gregory wrote a book called The Unintended Reformation. And he looks at unintended consequences of the Reformation that have, and one of them, interestingly, was because the Reformation caused a divided church, which I would argue, and he would argue, wasn't the intention of the Reformers. We decided it's better to agree to disagree. And we decided that that in the interest of truth, we would sacrifice unity. And he argues that the perpetuating and the increasingly schism-ridden effect of the church, one of the witnesses it presents to the world is that unity is impossible. So the implausibility of there being any kind of truth that actually people could unify under. So I'd say that one of the first steps that would be necessary is for serious efforts at restoration of Christian unity, beginning on the congregational level. I think of as grassroots ecumenism. And I think this can take a number of different forms. I've talked to a friend of mine who's headmaster of a Christian school that has, he says, 85 different congregations represented in his school, a non-church-related school, non-denominational. They have a statement of faith. It's a pretty minimal statement of faith. It's a little bit bigger than the 5 points we looked at here. And I said, well, and he says the problem they run into, anytime they try to institute a policy, even in their school, let alone advocating a policy for the nation, for a community, is people say, well, we're not a church. I'm not sure this fits what they teach in my church. So I've suggested that they work to, and they actually bring in clergy from some, a lot of these churches and say, what would a maximal statement of faith look like? What kind of statement of faith could we have that actually has, so what can we actually agree on about, say, the nature of marriage? Rather than have a minimal, and this is typical for parachurch organizations, they have a minimal statement of faith. So I think the confidence for the church speaking, and again, it's not as if the church prior to the Reformation that there was unanimity and agreement about everything by any means, but at least they agreed that we're going to argue together, and that the arguments actually had consequences and were important. But when it becomes a kind of every man for himself, and when the idea present that the theological informing of political life is purely subjective and arbitrary and idiosyncratic, then what happens is political life becomes dominated by purely materialistic and rights based kind of the kind of arbitration of rights, and so if we're really confident that that there is some truth that could inform political order, not that there's a simple logical chain that would lead from premises to one single conclusion, But if we're not convinced that truth can actually inform political life, then we shouldn't be surprised when things like gay marriage or your wonderful bathroom laws here in North Carolina become so controversial, because we're not convinced that public life should be ordered by truth. But I think, again, even within the church, I don't think people within the church are confident that there can be truth about politics, or there can be truth about cultural life. Does that address what you're asking at all?
Yeah.
I think some of us who have multi-generational churches notice that there's a real difference.
Yeah.
And sort of over whatever age it is crowd, the over 55 crowd. You said there are people who are more willing to die for America than the church.
Yeah.
It's certainly true of that crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is not true.
Yeah. I think that's right. Well, I think that what when O'Donovan talks about the moral unintelligibility, mm-hmm. See, I think there's a certain sense where the older generation, people my age and older, there's a kind of nostalgia for a time when there did seem to be moral intelligence.
Right.
And I would argue that moral intelligibility left the building decades ago. And there's holding on to this kind of nostalgia. And Ronald Reagan was a great manipulator of that nostalgia.
Yeah.
And people are hoping that Donald Trump can manipulate the nostalgia, can manipulate that as well. I mean, Make America Great Again it sounds like a General Motors advertising slogan. It's so content free, and yet it does appeal to some kind of sense of national identity. And I do think it does tie to this idea that Pinheiro was talking about a national mission. The fact that he mentioned that Bush and Obama actually appeal to this, there's something latent in the American breast. At least for people above a certain age. Now, maybe it's not there for younger people. I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that it's not there, not because they're not patriotic or whatever, but I think the idolatry of America is less plausible for younger people. Mm-hmm. But the question is then, are they still being given, and this is a challenge for the church, are they still being given an understanding of soteriology? You mentioned, are they still being given an understanding of the significance of their salvation, of salvation, of Christ's work of salvation, that is still very individualistic and still very personal and private? To what extent do they have an understanding that the message of the gospel is repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand, and that has consequences that reach out into political life? Now, they may want it. They may want that that's the case. I think that it's a natural thing to want it to be the case. I think it's a natural thing to want it to be the case, but not in a way that glorifies America or glorifies any nation state. But ultimately, for this is why I really think, I mean, I think we're living in a time when there's much more attention to an ecclesially focused faith, that is, a faith that's focused in the life of the church. I think one of the reasons, I know a lot of Presbyterians are nervous about how many people are converting to Catholicism or Orthodoxy, but I think one of the reasons the conversions happen is because of the fact that there is presented there an ecclesially centered faith, which I think was part of the Reformed tradition originally. Mm-hmm. But I think it got lost. It got lost partly because of the advent of modern liberalism. And so the displacement of a sense of communal identity in the church with a sense of communal identity in the nation. So I think you have a great opportunity with the millennials and or whatever generation it is. But I think you want to fill that. You don't. The danger is that they're also living in a kind of ad hocracy. They're living in a world in which everything is short-term commitments, immediate response, and disposability of everything. And so the idea of them being part of the idea of them committing for an intergenerational, making intergenerational commitments, which is something their parents or grandparents might have been willing to do, maybe for the wrong reasons, but it was a good thing to have that. That's actually a big theme in O'Donovan's idea of what constitutes legitimate political authority. He says one of the attributes, he isolates three things. One of the attributes of legitimate political authority is it sustains intergenerational continuity for a people over time. He talks about that in Common Objects of Love and in the Desire of the Nations. So that the idea of actually having a way of life that's shared and that you pass on to your children and your children's children, that's a good thing to want that. But the terms in which that happens and the context within which that happens, the sense of membership within which it happens, shouldn't be tied to the nation state, I don't think. It should be ultimately the church. I mean, I've come to think that, I know a lot of people say, well, we're living in a time when we should be less triumphalistic and, we're not a majority anymore and we need to get used to it. I think there's a sense in which the church always is. I mean, if we say Jesus is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, that's pretty triumphalistic. But there's a sense in which the task of the church is in a sacrificial, servant way to make the whole world like itself. So that ultimately what we want is we want every knee to bow. That doesn't happen at the point of a sword or through savvy marketing campaigns. It happens through sacrificial love and a willingness to make to give ourselves for our neighbors. So, but ultimately, I mean, I do think, and this may sound, I don't consider myself a post-millennialist, but there is a sense in which I do think that. That the life of the church, we are in a sense the avant-garde, we're what all of humanity is called to. Not that everyone is saved, I'm not saying that, but this is what the new humanity is. When Paul talks about the new creation, I think that's the new creation is evident in the life of the church, and not just evident in people's hearts, but it's evident in the communal life. And so then the church can bear witness in the lives of local congregations. I think it bears witness to the world as to what the kingdom of God looks like, and so the way we use power and the way we serve our neighbors, all of these things are bearing witness to what is intended for humanity, for renewed humanity, and that's. See, that's where I think about the political witness of the church. Political witness of the church doesn't start with partisan politics, or doesn't assume that statecraft, that politics is about statecraft. It assumes that it's for the good of the polis, it's for the good of the people, and a lot of things that have nothing to do with government. Not that government's not part of it, but a lot of things that have nothing to do with government contribute to that. So sorry to go on a long-winded. Excursion. Yeah.
I have just a question. You're a student. I mean, it's great having interviewed so many of these people.
Yeah.
And ever since the sections in the Westminster Confession were removed, which deals with public theology, we've been flailing in a vacuum.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And the reason I think we don't have a public theology is because we don't have a public theology.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first person, then we got sucker punched by the deists in our country.
Yeah.
And the Enlightenment, so put us back.
Right.
But really, is there anybody other than Abraham Kuyper who is doing positive public theology?
Yeah.
And Kuyper's disciples.
Yes. Yeah.
Is there anybody like I am not familiar with O'Donovan.
Yeah.
Is he a scholar?
Oh yeah.
No, does he have a political movement?
Oh no. He's a scholar.
He was just scholars.
Yeah.
But Kuyper did much more.
Oh yeah.
Think about.
Well, again, he is a scholar, mm-hmm. and he is trying to develop theological principles for action. Definitely for action. And there are people. There are people. Well, I tell you what. Here's a funny thing. There are, I know, when I think of people who are doing kind of front, more frontline sorts of things, they tend to be more in Great Britain than here in the States. So, for instance, there's a guy who I interviewed several years ago. I'm getting ready to interview him again. In fact, I just started reading. You probably heard of John Milbank, who maybe not. He's a but he has a guy he's worked with named Adrian Pabst. Adrian Pabst has degrees from London School of Economics. They've just co-written this book called The Politics of Virtue, Post-Liberalism and the Human Future, which is pretty interesting. I've just gotten into it, and I'm going to be interviewing them. But Pabst is involved with a couple of organizations in Great Britain that are offering, and I've seen articles he's written, I think, in The Guardian or The Telegraph, where he's basically commenting on nuts and bolts policy things. But it's all based on a pretty rich theological and philosophical understanding of political order. So the politics of virtue, what they're arguing there is that modern liberalism is based on kind of rights-based and certain understanding of freedom that orders politics. And the idea that political life, that shared public life should be about promoting the virtue of the citizenry. That's something we do on our own time. That's not something that has. We don't promote virtue publicly. At least that's the orthodoxy. That's the received orthodoxy now. I'm not sure that the founders were entirely. Obviously the founders were between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. They were in disagreement about that. But the party that won was a party that says, no, people need to be free to define their idea of the good. We can't impose some idea of the good or pursue a common idea of the good. And now that's where we are. Now look where we are. So these guys are saying liberalism is experiencing this meta-crisis, they say. And there's no way to repair. You know, I hear a lot of people say, if we could just get back to the 18th century and the founders, we could fix everything and everything would be hunky-dory. I think that's when things started to go pear-shaped. I think that's when things started to... That's not a solution. But again, so there are people who are saying... I'm blanking on the name. David Cameron had some people when he was running for prime minister who, again, who were working at the policy level in a sense, post-liberal concepts that were based on theological and on theological framework. I think we're going to see more people arise and do that. But and this is where the task of the church is to, it seems to me, the task that preachers have isn't to kind of formulate policy, but it is to inspire the imagination of your parishioners so that they will begin to realize, hey, I can think Christianly about public matters, inspire them rather than to figure out how can I be a mere... you talked about the deists. I think most Christians are moralistic, therapeutic deists in public. When it, you know, we scoff at that term that Chris Smith identified. But in fact, most people behave like deists. For most people, the Trinity, Christology, eschatology doesn't make any difference for how we think about public life. That's where I think I mentioned earlier, we think that the fall is more definitive than the fact that we're created in the image of a Trinitarian God, and we still bear that image, which means we are created in the image of a God who is love, and so that should have public consequences. That's the beginnings of our theological anthropology. And so how do public institutions recognize the necessity of relationality? Not in terms of kind of competition of rights, but in terms of one of the terms that was used is reciprocity. That's a term that showed up in Pope Benedict's Caritas in Veritate, one of his encyclicals, where he borrowed from a group of Italian economists who've been developing a Christian theory of economics that's rooted in the idea of reciprocity. So there's the idea of gift at the root of economic transactions. So there are people doing this and trying to figure out the policies. But the irony is there are fewer American Protestants. there are more Catholics and there are more non-Americans that are doing. American Protestants are so wedded to the Lockean individualism, I think. And part of the problem, you mentioned how the sections in the confession. I had actually the first, this is my first page of notes I made for this. Can we amend or reform the Reformed tradition? That was my first question I'm asking myself. I remember when I was at seminary asking, what would it take for the PCA to amend the Westminster Confession? What would it
take? Jesus comes.
An angel from heaven. So, because just from, you know, it seems to me that there must have been questions that weren't even thought of to be asked in the 17th century. And there are challenges that we face culturally that the Westminster divines never asked. Mm-hmm. And so so what would it take to actually ask some different questions? Now, I'm not saying come up with an entirely new framework, but what would it take, and this is even more radical maybe, what would it take to say that the Westminster divines actually may have been may have been distracted by the intellectual climate of the 17th century, mm-hmm. and may have had some blind spots. I'm not saying they're wrong. I won't say wrong. But they may have had some blind spots and may have been some prejudices in the way they thought about things that we can help reform the Reformed tradition. That's one thing. I speak in a lot of different denominational settings, and one of the things I find interesting is among the conservatives, no matter what, you know, it's Reformed, Wesleyan, Anglican, Catholic, whoever they are, they all think that their tradition has all the answers to meet the kind of crises that we're faced with now. And I think we're actually at a time when we need to talk across those denominational lines, across those confessional lines, and basically say, well, maybe the God has given gifts to these different fragments of the church that we need to Kuyperians need to learn, listen to Catholics, and Wesleyans need to listen to Anglicans, and maybe the kind of civilizational crisis we're living through is a time when we need to I'm not saying abandon our traditions, but we need to reform our traditions in light of what wisdom God has given to other traditions. Mm-hmm. That may be heretical, but so be it.
I sense that Mennonites have a fairly well thought out approach to public life. At least they're way ahead of the mm-hmm. Americans. They were forced to.
Yeah.
But I'm confused about Catholics. Now, who is the point of the spear?
Yeah.
In terms of public theology,
there's a lot of disagreement and debate, but it is interesting to one of the things that the Catholic Church has going for it is that you do have these kind of authoritative statements that come out, and then they debate the authoritative statements. But at least, so you know, Pope Benedict writes what he wrote 3 encyclicals. John Paul II wrote more. So they become points of reference. They don't become kind of the last word, you know, read it and shut up. They actually become points of reference which then are debated within the church. And so the role that those encyclicals play, it seems to me as an outsider, is they establish a common vocabulary and a common set of questions and to some extent a common framework, which in the course of time, which in the course possibly of generations, can actually bear fruit. And for instance, there's an economist. Actually, he may not be an economist. He teaches at the Business School of Catholic University. His name is Andrew Abella, and I'm going to interview him soon. He's written a book on it's called something like A Catechism for Business. And what he's doing is taking Catholic social teaching through a number of encyclicals for the last 100 years and saying, okay, here's this framework of understanding about economics and community. That's theologically rooted. How can we make practical application of that for within business? And now there are some Protestants who do that as well. But unfortunately, in a sense, it's kind of entrepreneurial in the Protestant side because we don't have a shared body of things that we all have to wrestle with. Now, maybe that's the case if you're in the Christian Reformed Church and everybody has to wrestle with Kuyper or Dooyeweerd or whoever. But you know, I don't know. In the Presbyterian tradition, who do you refer to? Daphne? you know, where do you go to find a kind of, okay, here's a seminal text that we all have to wrestle with. Yeah. And so that's where I think, and again, I don't know how that's, I know that within ecclesial bodies like the PCA, there's a nervousness about even venturing in that way, partly because of, you know, I just gave an inaugural address at Geneva College a few weeks ago, and Geneva College is Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, the Covenanters. And of course, they were very much involved in effort for decades, maybe centuries, to amend the U.S. Constitution to acknowledge the kingship of Christ officially. And in fact, it wasn't until 1969 that members of the RPCNA were allowed to vote or hold public office. 1969, because they believed that the American government was an illegitimate government because it didn't formally acknowledge the kingship of Christ. Now, then on the other hand, you have my friends in the Two Kingdoms world, like Daryl Hart and others, friends of mine, who are so contrary to that. So here you have, just within the American Presbyterian tradition, you have these views that are poles apart. And my sense is they never talk to each other. Mm-hmm. They never get together and say, you know, we have the Westminster Confession in common. We should at least talk to each other. We both can't be right. So if we're not both right, what would it take for us to actually talk to each other? And then, and so what ends up happening, they end up speaking to the people within their own denominational tradition. And that, I think, that's unfortunate. I think that, and so we need to get over that territorialism, it seems to me, partly for the sake of making a public witness, but also for making it plausible to the members of our congregations that actually there are some objective truths involved here, and this isn't just kind of playing with rhetoric. Yeah.
I'm starting to get there with our conversation during the break. You know, I think where I'm stuck is, you know, brief background, a lot of the formation of my church, so I planted a church 7 years ago, was birthed out of my relationship with my father. Hmm. And my dad was heavily involved in local politics in Raleigh, North Carolina, Democratic side. Most of my experience in church post-conversion has been in conservative churches where there is no way my dad could have engaged in and not feel excluded in some form or fashion.
Right.
And so when I started this church, it was birthed out of this desire of, is it possible that I could try to build a church that me and my dad could actually cohabitate in?
Right.
And bring unity in the midst of political polar opposites.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of the formation of our church, and that's part of why, you know, I mentioned it there. I did not tell people who I vote for.
Yeah, yeah.
Birth out of this desire to use my dad's and his relationship as a way to figure out if Democrats and Republicans
can
converse and be in community together.
Yeah.
And I think where I'm stuck is knowing that all of what we're talking about here is the public nature of our faith and how to bring in our theology into the public life.
Yeah.
And how to do that now that I've got a church that has people all over the map.
Right.
I don't want to risk unity because I want to fight for that.
Yeah.
But we have such an ad hoc, non-committal community that at the first thought of anything that people don't like, they bolt.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm in this spot where I'm like, how much unity do I need to build such that they have the collective maturity,
right?
We have the collective maturity as a church to engage in conversations.
Yeah.
Like, let's talk about Hillary and Trump.
Yeah.
And it not actually destroy the very thing
Trump. Well, again, my sense is, and my sense is that there has to be. Well, let me ask a pointed question. Do you want a church where your dad might be forced to change his mind for theological reasons? In other words, my sense is most people I know, most Christians I know who have strong political convictions have not come to those convictions because of theologically based reflection. And so so they haven't actually wrestled with an understanding of, say, the nature of political authority or the nature of political structures. And so they basically accept the terms of political order that have, that we've inherited from the Enlightenment. And they say, based on that order, we're going to make decisions which amount to prudential judgments, which, you know, people may come to different prudential judgments. But it seems to me it ought to be possible for there to be an effort to come to unanimity that's theologically rooted at some level. And then we can still disagree possibly on policies. So for instance, I mean, even to talk about, to reflect on how might the incarnation have consequences for political, for thinking about the common good, for instance. I know in 2004, when Kerry and Bush were running against each other, Alistair McIntyre, who I mentioned earlier, he published an article saying he refused to vote. He said the most important political thing he did that year was to not vote for either candidate because he felt that they weren't even asking the right questions about political order. And so now, again, unfortunately, in America, politics is so partisan. It's so tied to parties. One of the things I'm hoping will come out of this season of zaniness is the demolition of a two-party system, just because I don't think prudentially it makes sense for a country this big to only have two choices and to have a kind of winner-take-all approach. And so I think the whole questions of the political structures is something that should, again, for reasons rooted in a kind of theological anthropology, notions of understanding of community. And that's, again, that takes, I don't want to encourage a conversation about Trump or Hillary until we've had some of these earlier conversations. But unfortunately, that's what happens in most churches. It becomes a conversation about Trump or Hillary, which I think is, again, I think it's premature. Yeah.
So I feel like James Hansen Hunter offers a mediating position between that, like, two kingdoms view and the transformations view. So rather than thinking through political positions based on a theological presupposition, like, hey, let's find as many public spaces as we can that aren't politicized and go there and do things there. And therefore, so the role of the church becomes a non-political public space.
Yeah.
Do you
well, I think there's something. We're talking about James because James is an old friend of mine, and we to some extent we've diverged a little bit over time. I mean, I actually helped him with one of his books, After Culture Wars, and he was on my board for a while. I felt that to change the world. Well, he says, you know, he didn't write the last chapter because he didn't write the chapter about the church. He basically says that. He acknowledges that the church is a not strong presence in that book.
And it's the critique is better than the solution.
Yeah. Well, and I think, but see, the question I want to ask is, can you mount a critique if you haven't done the theological work, particularly work in the nature of the church in the world? And the people I'm reading that I think are really interesting are people who are basically taking, I guess what you could call it, a kind of eschatological approach. That is, they're saying, what is God doing in history, and what role does the church play in what God does in history? Not that we are looking at specific things happening, specific events, but what does it mean for the kingdom of God to be coming in historically? And then how can the church, as the church, not just the church, one thing I'm nervous about, in James's book almost depicts the church as an equipping agency for individuals, but the church itself as Well, you talked about it as a kind of alternative public, in a sense. And that is, I think, exactly how we ought to think of the church, as a kind of alternative public space, mm-hmm. as an alternative polis, as a polis that in a sense, not stands over against America or whatever, but a polis that has a kind of identity, a sense of a political identity and that isn't restricted to what the American formulas would necessarily require. So I don't think, in a sense, I would say to change the world into the church. I mean, in a sense, what are we changing the world into? And so I want to build a kind of ecclesial and eschatological basis for the. I think the sociological historical critique is really great. I actually interviewed James about that book, and we focused on the first third of the book. But I do think it would still be better if there was more theological reflection early on. There's a danger. I think I'm not picking on James, but I think there's a danger for us to assume that we understand these social and historical and political problems. We use the tools of social science and do our work to analyze the problem, and then theology comes in to help us formulate a solution. I want to see if are there ways that we can work, and there are scholars who are doing this, who are basically saying, let's bring theological categories into the structure of our analysis of the disorder, not just as a kind of okay, now that we've used essentially theologically free resources to diagnose it, let's bring theology in earlier on. I want to read on that note, and then we should get started. Is this fruitful at all? I mean, is this?
Ken, this is a great dialogue. I know it's very helpful, but because some guys are driving,
I'm going to finish right at 9:30.
Okay,
I plan on that. Let me read from Hans Boersma's book, Heavenly Participation, from the beginning of it. He's, if you don't know him, he's the J.I. Packer Professor of Theology at Regent College. And how, with a name like Boersma and the J.I. Packer Professor, how reformed can you get, actually? He says, it is difficult for Christians, whether Catholic or evangelical, to imagine a time when theology was regarded as the most important discipline. The modern period has taught us to look to other sources as the main guides for establishing our life together. The argument that theology is the most authoritative guide for our common public life seems profoundly presumptuous to many who have grown up in modern liberal democracies. In fact, many will claim that such a high view of theology strikes at the very root of our cultural arrangement. I will not dispute the claim. It seems to me unsurprising and even logical, considering that modernity takes its cue from earthly rather than heavenly realities. I find myself in agreement with John Milbank's oft-quoted statement, quote, the pathos of modern theology is its false humility. For theology, false humility must be a fatal disease. If theology no longer seeks to position, qualify, or criticize other discourses, then it is inevitable that these discourses will position theology. Now, I think that, again, just as religion has been privatized and marginalized, so theology has been siloed off so that theology is a special discipline rather than theology being a kind of ordering discipline. Not that all disciplines are just theology in a different key, but it does, because what Milbank is saying, that theology should position, qualify, or criticize other disciplines. It stands, again, as the queen of sciences that orders. Milbank historically has been particularly critical of social sciences, which social sciences, as we know them, particularly sociology, arises as a post-Christian kind of discipline. If we no longer have theological categories to understand and guide public order, then we need a set of scientific, allegedly neutral resources. Now, again, one of the great things about post-modernity is it basically challenges the idea of the neutrality of these allegedly neutral Enlightenment disciplines. Christians have been nervous about the postmodern because they think it leads to relativism, but I think postmodern is, to the extent that it challenges the idea that these that there is, or one guy I interviewed said, there is no epistemological Switzerland. That is, every claim, every knowledge claim or truth claim is spoken from somewhere. It's spoken from within some framework of understanding. And I think, you know, we're only at the beginning of overcoming that kind of enlightenment assumption, and particularly with regard to politics. We still think about politics in, as if it's kind of just a, it's like engineering. It's just a kind of a mechanical thing. I want to, we'll talk more tomorrow. I think the best thing right now might be for me to start this O'Donovan feature, and I want to end right at 9:30. We'll have a little bit of time. We want time to talk about it afterwards. We'll have a little time, a couple points where I may stop and just underscore something he said. This actually, you can hear, if you want to hear this again, there's our website, marshillaudio.org. If you go down to the bottom right-hand corner of the homepage, there's a link to a page that has this content on it. And also, there's a podcast version of it on iTunes. If you just search for my name, or search Oliver O'Donovan, and Oliver O'Donovan doesn't show up a whole lot in iTunes. this is the beginning of a set of features that we're doing on political theology. This is a special feature from Mars Hill Audio. I'm Ken Myers, host of the Mars Hill Audio Journal. The campaign leading up to the presidential election of 2016 has been an unsettling season for many Americans. Against the disturbing backdrop of social and cultural fragmentation, the two principal candidates for the office seem to be equally divisive, so that whoever wins in November, we're certain to be living through a time of further discord and discontent. As I've read and heard pundits and commentators analyze this surreal cultural and political scene, most of the observations seem to be like those of every other election year, focusing on polling statistics, the machinery of campaigning, fact-checking of claims made in speeches, and, perhaps more than usual, the personalities of the candidates. Maybe I'm not reading the right sources, but I haven't seen much discussion of whether the sad state of political life is an indication of the falseness or inadequacy of some of our established assumptions about politics. In other words, is what we're living through a sign of the failure of our political structures, or is it the logical outcome of a system with critical design flaws? Does a more hopeful future require the radical revision of some basic beliefs about public life, about the relationship between state and society, about the purposes of government, and about how the ordering of temporal affairs must account for the full reality of what we are as human persons? These and other relevant questions are finally theological questions, even if they're not always acknowledged as such. Modern political thought is characterized by the assumption that we must think about politics as if God didn't exist. Theology and politics are kept safe by a wall of separation. But that claim is already a theological claim, and a contestable one. A lot of public conversation that passes for neutral and religious talk actually smuggles all sorts of theological assumptions into play. I think we're living in a moment when the pretense of secularism, the claim that life can be understood and organized perfectly well as if God didn't exist, needs to be unmasked. And I think that the social and political disquiet sensed by many citizens will not be well understood or addressed without relying on theological resources. So Mars Hill Audio is launching a series of special interviews that discuss politics as if God did exist. This series will include a number of freshly conducted interviews, as well as some from our audio archives. Our goal is to re-examine some questions that many consider to have been settled. We believe, as do many of our interviewees, that the conventional answers about the meaning of politics are inadequate, and that our current political situation presents an opportunity for some rethinking. So instead of offering our voice to the many analyses of how Christians should vote this November, we'll take a step back from that precipice with some reflection about long-term reorganization. My guest on this first outing is moral philosopher Oliver O'Donovan, who from 2006 to 2012 was professor of Christian ethics and practical theology at the School of Divinity, New College, Edinburgh.
From 1982 until 2006, he was Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology and Canon of Christ Church at the University of Oxford. Oliver O'Donovan's most comprehensive study of theology and politics was his 1996 book, The Desire of the Nations, Rediscovering the Roots of Political Theology. In that book, O'Donovan summarized the task of politics in terms of liberation, rule, and community foundation. These tasks, performed by secular governments, nevertheless, quote, provide us with partial indications of what God is doing in human history, close quote. The gospel declares, and Christians affirm, that God rules, and as he rules in history, the church has affirmed that God rules through governments. The reality of the rule of God, the kingdom of God, is a necessary point of reference if we're to understand politics correctly. In October 2013, while the U.S. government was shut down over disputes about the federal budget, Oliver O'Donovan made a rare visit to Capitol Hill for a public conversation about the gospel and public life. The event was held a few blocks from the relatively darkened Capitol building before a group of about 160 congressional and executive branch staff people, Christian activists, clergy, theologians, and assorted laypeople. The conversation was convened by Matthew Lee Anderson, one of the principal contributors to the blog MereOrthodoxy.com. Anderson and I sat on either side of Professor O'Donovan for an intense hour-and-a-half conversation. That entire event is available as streaming audio on the Mars Hill Audio website, but here are some highlights, beginning with O'Donovan's response to my request that he explain how the word secular has changed in its meaning and thereby barred theological claims from shaping public life.
Historically, the word secular meant to do with the affairs of this world, i.e. it was the life of creation extended into history as distinct from the intervention into this world and the work in this world of God in redeeming it and saving it. So every Christian lived a secular life and a spiritual life in that a Christian is engaged, has tasks, has a life to live within the common terms of a common world, and at the same time an awareness and response to the work of God in saving it. And I think it's very important because the word secular has so radically shifted its sense in late modernity that we remember that's where it began. Understand how we use the word and how we're using the word when we use it.
Historically, secular meant temporal, not neutral or religion-free. So there was no contradiction in speaking of Christian secular political order, a temporal order that was organized in light of eternal concerns. There's nothing in the nature of temporal life as such to exclude guidance from religious sources. The modern prohibition of religious claims about human nature, the common good, and the role of government from having a role in secular life is not a theologically neutral commitment. And for O'Donovan, it's not a commitment that is consistent with a Christian understanding of what government is called to do and to be. Just as the modern meaning of secular has excluded an understanding of human life that acknowledges the spiritual center of human being, so the modern definition of public is dehumanizingly narrow and restrictive. In commenting on the definition of public, in the common phrase public reason, O'Donovan has written that the modern public is constructed by privation. Rather than an inclusive and open space, quote, it refuses to admit moral identities formed behind its back in private. The publicity of public reason, it appears, is less like the town square we imagine lying before our front door, more like a walled and barbed wire garrison bristling with warnings against entry by unauthorized personnel, close quote. Modern liberalism informs Christians and other believers that they have to check their deepest convictions at the door before entering public space. During our public conversation, O'Donovan said that this violates the possibility of relationship that should be present in public life.
A public existence is a communicating existence. I mean, things become public when they don't remain locked up in my breast, but are offered in society and in fellowship and in love to another person or to other people, and in which there is receiving and giving. And public has to do with the appearing of what we are truthfully and fully to a world which is constituted for the moment as a receiving world, and an openness to the two-way engagement with that world. A public in which one cannot, in some sense, present that which is most important for other human beings is a public that is imprisoning and destructive. And so we have to watch what is done with that word.
When Christians play by the distinctively modern rules of public life, they abandon the possibility of enunciating what their neighbors need to hear most, not just for their eternal condition, but for life lived now, life within political, economic, and other cultural institutions. O'Donovan has written that theology must be political if it is to be evangelical, that is, true to the gospel. Rule out the political questions, and you cut short the proclamation of God's saving power. You leave people enslaved where they ought to be set free from sin, their own sin and others. Close quote. I think it's very common for Christians to try to avoid saying things in public that might sound strange or radically distinctive. To be well-mannered in public means to have nothing to say that challenges the status quo. By contrast, O'Donovan challenged his audience to remember that the Incarnation and the Resurrection introduced a model in which a previously unthinkable reality challenged the conventional framework of thinking, a challenge that had and still has political consequences.
Are we afraid to say that living for God, involves postures, patterns, initiatives that are not immediately comprehensible to other people? It seems to me if we talk about being given life from the dead, we talk about being put in a strange situation, a situation that's paradoxically related to the world as it goes on its merry way, or very much part of that world, always within the terms of that world, and yet all the time questioning its dynamics, opening it up. And the meaning of new life has to be, among other meanings, a disturbing meaning, in which what we can't do is say, well, there's the world, and that's all right on its own terms, let it go in its way, and then we'll now attend to relating to God quite separately from that. That's not the way God related to us, I'm inclined to say. He came to suffer and die under Pontius Pilate. And there is a model for the life we will be called to and given to live.
The fact that the Creed mentions Pontius Pilate is a reminder that Christ's kingship has always been engaged with political, public, secular authorities. What rulers do and what God is doing are two different questions, but they're necessarily related questions. During our conversation, Oliver O'Donovan was asked about the possibility of defining the role of government without reference to theological ideas.
Are there ways of legitimating government that has nothing to do with the activity of God? Put it that way, which I just did. And I think the answer is no. But are there ways in which the community can judge the activity, performance, and validity of claims by those who seek to govern over against the act of God and his purposes? The answer is yes, there are. It seems to me the key to this relationship is the simple utterance that as the citizen is subject to the authority of the law and the court, so is the lawmaker and the executive ruler subject to the authority of the law of God and his court. That is to say, nobody is in authority in this world who is not under authority. To be in authority is to be under authority, and the extent to which one can recognize authority in an instance that seeks to govern is the extent to which one can see its submission to the authorizing act of God, and its capacity to fulfill the terms which God has laid down. So the principle of the law of God as being the framework within which any government may have legitimacy or term is very important, I think, in my view. And one can see it is that which enables one to make rough but understandable judgments about when regimes totter over the edge from being lawful government in some unsatisfactory but very real sense into being mere tyrannies, and so on.
In The Desire of the Nations, Oliver O'Donovan asserted that, quote, the kingdom of God is not a mere kingdom, but it is a real kingdom, close quote. When we talked on Capitol Hill, I asked him to explain what he meant by that claim.
Speaking of God, we inevitably use a range of pictures. It's very easy for us to say, we speak of God as Father. What we mean is that he's like a father. What we mean is that he's like a father in certain ways, perhaps, and then perhaps not like a father in other ways. And then perhaps that God is something unspeakable, of which certain clues may be given to us in the language of fatherhood. We need to know how this image works. And of God as king and as God as father, I want to say what Paul says about fatherhood, from whom all fatherhood in heaven and earth are named. That is to say, don't think of your father as the original and God as, oh, in some sort of vague resemblance to that. Think of it the other way around. Think of the reality as being there in this extraordinary relationship we have to our Creator, who has loved and given us into being. And then see pale reflections of that in your parenting and in your child relationship. Now, it's the same with kingdom. It's very easy for us, as it were, to step inch by inch back from the political content of this and say, well, of course, I disapprove of governments. So God can't be like a government in any very sort of significant way. I mean, he's a bit like a government, yes, in that I don't understand what he does. Sometimes he doesn't seem to be there.
Seems to be on furlough sometimes.
Yes, that's right. But not really. Now, I think we're warned. This is a dangerous train of thought. We are not invited, as it were, to evacuate the metaphor like that. Rather, we should say the governments we know are pale reflections in the order of creation of what God does for the world and what God is for the world. Very inadequate reflections from here and there, but not because they are too much government, but because they are very much too little government, as God understands government. So we've got to start our political thinking from there, from what we're shown, the government we're shown, the government of the world by God. This is a fearfully unfashionable thing to do. I mean, as I utter this thought, I realize how I was flying in the face of everything modern when I said that. And yet, I'll repeat it here for you. So.
In his survey of how Yahweh's authority as king is described in the Old Testament, O'Donovan isolates three conditions or characteristics that have an analogous presence in legitimate earthly governments. First, Yahweh accomplishes victorious deliverance or salvation for his people. Second, he exercises judicial discrimination. He is and will be a righteous judge. And third, he assures the historical continuity of their people and their ways in their land. O'Donovan later summarizes, quote, "Political authority arises where power, the execution of right, and the perpetuation of tradition are assured together in one coordinated agency," close quote. And later, quote, "that any regime should actually come to hold authority, and should continue to hold it, is a work of divine providence in history, not a mere accomplishment of the human task of political service," close quote. This last phrase underscores O'Donovan's commitment to the claim that the meaning of the kingdom of God is that God rules, not that God defined a set of rules and then stepped aside to see what his creatures might do with them. O'Donovan believes that governments that fail to serve their societies in terms of power, justice, and the sustaining of communal identity soon lose their legitimacy.
I believe the state has a duty of attention and responsibility to the most fundamental convictions and commitments of the society it serves. Mm. That is to say, if the state has allowed itself to get in a position when it regards a certain exercise of religious freedom as illegal, and the majority of right-thinking people, if we can invoke such a very vague concept, in that society does not regard it illegal, the state has got itself into a position which it has to get out of somehow. Because the state's role is to manifest the judgment of God in ways that allow that judgment to appear to the consciences of its people. Now, this doesn't mean that a state cannot take, one might say, a higher moral ground than the average citizen in a community and insist on rather more than comes naturally. States frequently have to do this, and it's right that they should do this. But the principles on which the state acts at their root must be comprehensible morally to the people who are governed. Because if they're not, then the state is failing in the role God has given it, which is to manifest his judgment. And so states cannot have what might call purely statist views of what we'll do as religious liberty, views which officials have which nobody else has. That's a position in which the state risks illegitimizing itself vis-a-vis its society. And that's serious.
In The Desire of the Nations, which is O'Donovan's exploration of the political consequences of the kingship of Christ, there's a chapter on the church in which he claims that, quote, "a theological account of how this world is ruled must proceed from and through an account of the church," close quote. Later, quote, "decisions about the nature of church authority have shaped and still shape what is said about secular government," close quote. And still later in that chapter, quote, "describing the church as a political society means to say that it is brought into being and held in being not by a special function it has to fulfill, but by a government that it obeys in everything. It is ruled and authorized by the ascended Christ alone and supremely. It therefore has its own authority, and it is not answerable to any other authority that may attempt to subsume it," close quote. Toward the end of our conversation, Matt Anderson and I asked Dr. O'Donovan about the public responsibility of the church. I asked him to enumerate the activities in which the political nature of the church are most evident.
Preaching and praying, without any doubt, which are the ways in which the community forms itself together as a community in obedience to the word of God it is hearing and responding to. nothing is more central than those. All kinds of things spin off it. You can go anywhere from preaching and praying, one might say. And in this situation or that situation or the other situation, you'll come up with a program. Mm. And it may be just right. A different program from the next church. That's fine. But if this central work of coming to communal self-recognition in context, in the context of the world around, is not done, then the activism will be ineffective. One of the points of responsibility anyone who ever preaches has is to ask him or herself how the exposition and exploration of the scriptures and the pulpit can give this community a sense of its corporate witness, a sense of its identity in Christ and its ability to live as a body within the world. And this is the constant task set before the preacher every time, it seems to me, whatever the theme of the preaching may be.
Perhaps the most important political witness the church bears in the world is to make evident the larger context in which political institutions and actions are to be evaluated.
The church's witness to the kingdom of God always holds up a memory and an anticipation of forms of social relating and enactment that are not captured by the juridical and institutional structures of civil society and its government. And that is what the being of the church in the middle of a society must always do. So, just to take a very simple, concrete instance, the state punishes, it sends those it punishes to prison. The church visits prisons. There is an antithesis. Not an opposition, but a real antithesis, a real dialectic there, in which the church's role is to say, remember that the act which and the decision which produced this situation, however necessary, however right on its own terms, is a relative, temporary provision, and God has something else for the future. And that, I think, is the kind of relationship I see as emerging between the church as a community and the civil political side.
But that is a kind of political witness. It's not extra political, finally.
Yes, it is. It is.
Why is it not just kind of therapeutic extra political? What makes it a political witness?
Because it has a social message. And it has a message about the future of political organization of society and God's determination to bring justice to judgment, in the phrase of the psalm. That the reconciliation of the world involves the suspension, the marking of the limits of the significance of the political organization. The kings of the world are judged. That is a very crucial message. So what you say about, say, visiting a prisoner in prison as opposed to just visiting him because he's a friend or you're sorry for him, but you're also saying something about the structures that render this kind of calculated imposition of human misery necessary, and you assume they do render them necessary.
You're not visiting.
You're not subverting them.
But
you are framing them in a much bigger context.
Dr. Oliver O'Donovan, fellow of the British Academy and professor emeritus of Christian ethics and practical theology at the University of Edinburgh. His books on political theology include The Desire of the Nations and The Ways of Judgment. In April 2017, the third book of his trilogy, Ethics as Theology, will be released, and that volume is entitled Entering into Rest. Our conversation, which included Matthew Lee Anderson, was held in Washington, D.C. on October 8, 2013. On the next in this series of special features on political theology, I'll talk with theologian Peter Leithart on how worship forms us politically.
Every time we worship, we're performing a political act, and we're being formed as political actors. The fact that churches might be doing that unconsciously, I think, is a problem. If churches are conscious of the fact that worshiping the High King is a political act, mm-hmm. and that worship is a way of training political sensibilities, then I think churches will be more effective in forming Christian political actors.
That conversation with Peter Leithart will be on the next in this series on political theology.
Okay, so that last thing on visiting prisoners is the most provocative part, I think. And the idea that, and it couples with what Leithart says there, anticipating the next interview, where, and the section on preaching and praying, the idea of preaching to convey a sense of corporate witness. My sense is that most American preaching is aimed at individuals. It's aimed to help individuals grow in their personal spiritual life. The idea that you're preaching in order to form a sense of corporate identity and a recognition that that the first person plural, not the first person singular, is the pronoun that characterizes our presence in the world. And I don't know if you're taught to do that in seminary. I don't know. It'd be interesting to go to the homiletics classes and see whether that is, again. So let me, since you guys are mostly preachers and elders, those last two things particularly, preaching and praying and visiting prisoners, what are some of your reactions to that?
I'll say right off that I think he makes a really good point. I really liked it, and you highlighted it there. That preaching ought to help define the church as a group in the world.
Yeah.
But your question about, so I'm a preacher. I preach every week.
Yeah.
And I think I preach more to the individual than I would like, and this is not the first time I've thought about that. But our church has got a good relationship with a couple African American churches,
yeah.
and I think that they have intuitively a much better sense of preaching
yeah.
as a way of
yeah.
speaking to public life as a community
yeah.
and moving out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Who? Yeah,
I think
yeah.
they are not as individualistic.
Right. Yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah.
As white churches at least.
Yeah. Any other comments on this? Yeah.
So when you mentioned less than new again before, and I think when I definitely err towards individuals and college students, but when I do preach towards the corporate community aspect, it's as a model that the body could invite others into.
Yeah.
And that's still sort of an individual end or sort of a reaching towards
yeah.
it's not towards public life or sort
yeah.
of generation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So even when I think corporately, it's almost as a lure.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. And of course, it is that. I mean, it is that. So we're inviting people into this body so that we can be a presence in the world. So and again, an alternative community in some way.
Yeah.
But not. And I think there's a tendency. I'm sure a lot of churches see themselves to be an alternative community means we pull up the drawbridge, put the wagons
yeah,
in a
right.
circle, and we're an alternative community and don't. But the idea of being an alternative community in the world, and for our witness for it to be a public witness of being present. I think evangelicals. Mm-hmm. Find that typically, I think they find that that sounds like social gospel, or it sounds like. I don't want to say too much. I want you guys to respond to this. Any of the other content that?
The prisoner comment was interesting. It reminded me in my prior church we had an elder who was being investigated by Child Protective Services. For abuse of adopted children.
Mm.
And it was a real vexing situation because when you got children involved, there's no pastor, parishioner, confidentiality. You are summonable to testify in court. And so we're trying to pursue church discipline to try to get to the truth. But what was a striking realization was we're trying to get to the truth unto reconciliation. The state wants to get to the truth unto condemnation. And so we really wrestled with, can we do our investigation before the state? Because we're summonable.
Yeah.
And whole truth, not but the truth. And so we, I don't know if it was wise or not, but we felt like we had to wait until the state was done before we could begin ours, because we didn't we didn't want to be used as an instrument of condemnation. Yeah. Our whole purpose was confession unto reconciliation.
Yeah.
And so
that's
so you know, that was a just one of those again, goosebumps now thinking back on just how, you know, and the state has its does have a sword it was given by God, So I'm not trying to undermine that, but how you try to, you know, that image of the state may do its condemning, and then you go do the reconciling, you know, even through bars.
So,
You know, and so it was a profound
word. So, the state doesn't have the last word. The state has a word and has a, has that role to play.
Yeah.
And that, again, he said that's there's a kind of dialectic that makes it kind of paradoxical. But, it, again, that's how, I think, to bear witness that way, rather than, you know, I think of back in the 60s when the kind of law and order, you know, Christians were lining up behind Spiro Agnew and kind of a law and order idea. And there was no notion at all that there's some kind of paradoxical antithesis, that the church actually represents, yes, we believe in law and order, but we also believe in forgiveness and reconciliation as an ultimate thing. That doesn't mean you're soft on crime. Of course, and of course, liberal Christians might have been saying, "Well, yeah, you know, we have to just forgive, and that we don't want the state to punish." And so, either left or right, if I can use those terms, misses the kind of complex thing that he's describing. Which,
it seems that authoritarian governments, like perhaps the Chinese governments, understand the church as an alternative community better than the church.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they. It's a threat.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Governments throughout all history.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's that's you know, I've heard years ago with the line that I think it was a youth pastor saying, you know, if you were accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? You know that. So the church in America is not perceived as a challenge or a potential threat to the exercise of power by the state. Not that we want to subvert the state as such, but we want to hold the state. But we believe that the state needs to be held accountable to again, that idea that anyone in authority is under authority. So and it seems to me that that's one of the roles the church has in its proclamation, is to actually declare the nature of the authority, not always in a rebuking way, sometimes in a congratulatory way, to say that we're grateful that the state has exercised its authority appropriately under God. And and sometimes it may be unfortunate that the state only speaks out when it's upset with the church, or the church only speaks out when it's upset with the state. But yeah, that idea that... I think, again, I said earlier that I think sometimes churches see themselves as chaplaincies to the American way of life, and the governments typically are happy with that. My sense is that the American way of life, as conventionally understood, is going to be less and less obviously something Christians can affirm, and not that it necessarily should have been for the last 50 years, but I think that... I think that it's much more plausible, and this gets to the point about younger people maybe finding the idea that the church is just a chaplaincy. I think that they're already finding that more and more implausible.
It makes me wonder if, you know, the more quickly we can get to a place where the church and Christians become more and more of a minority.
Yeah.
And experience more and more potential resistance from the government, potentially persecution, we may actually be in a better position to actually offer up the church as something that is distinct from politics. Because that just feels like that's so much of what we're dealing with is just the reality of how the church has kind of been in bed with politics.
Yeah, oh yeah.
It's hijacked the word evangelicalism.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I don't want to use the word because it's got such a politically tinge.
Yeah.
And so I'm almost like feeling like, gosh, the more persecuted we become, we might be in a better position to offer and to advance the kind of reality you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, we don't want to suffer from persecution envy. I mean, you know, one of the points that O'Donovan made in that longer interview was that the early church was very careful at a time when martyrdom was not uncommon. The early church was very eager to make sure people weren't kind of volunteering for martyrdom when it wasn't necessary. They didn't. The early church was very scrupulous about saying, you know, don't become. I called it entrepreneurial martyrdom. That, you know, don't become a martyr. You know, martyrdom is a last step, not a first step. That's right. don't jump into that. We need to quit. It's 9:30, and you guys have been really patient.
Can I make just a request, maybe for tomorrow morning? Earlier tonight, you mentioned, and I won't be long here, but I thought, you know, like I had thought about, gosh, this is one of those moments where, you know, the Hillary-Trump thing, how then do you vote? And I wrestled with whether or not to try and convene an evening, not a, quote, preaching evening, but an evening of sort of trying to discern what are the wisdom factors that come into play as to whether or not you would choose to vote for this person or that person. And our churches are divided. I suspect our presbytery is divided in how it's going to vote. I don't know what that division is, but between not voting, third-party votes, Hillary or Trump. And I just wonder, and you pushed back with a great question, you know, what are the conversations, even before you get to Hillary and Trump, they need to have to even inform Hillary, Trump?
Right.
And I just wonder constructively, if you had a taxonomy of those discussions, you know, it's sort of like a series of discussions that would lead people to more thoughtful categories for public theology and for, you know, even if not full consensus on who we're going to vote for, being able to get fairly far in terms of a common...
Yeah.
And then lead those discussions at each of our churches.
Well, I figure you can't do that, but at least help guide us in some of that. Constructively, if you were leading it in your church.
Well, I mean, I cast this out. I was going to use this earlier as a point for discussion that I realized I didn't want to take the time for. But this is a piece Peter Laird posted recently that I think gets at the kind of thing you're talking about. He's basically saying, well, what... He's giving the most charitable, what I think is the most charitable reading of the pro-Trump voter. And then he's basically raising questions about, fundamental questions about the nature of politics, the nature of political leadership based on that. And there have been other people written, but I thought this was particularly apt. And, I mean, I think there are obviously so many questions that... about this, and I think the thing I find most troubling is the irrational demonization of Hillary Clinton. I'm not a Hillary fan by any means, but the irrational. I mean, it's like she's the whore of Babylon and the Antichrist, all at once. And the other thing that seems to be, I get emails from friends that say, "Well, you got to vote for Trump to keep Hillary and to protect our religious freedoms." Alan Jacobs had a great piece on his little blog recently. So I finally understand. We have to set aside our Christian convictions and vote for Trump so he can protect us from Hillary, who wants us to set aside our Christian convictions.
That's good. That's good. That's good.
And there's this kind of visceral animosity that's present that really scares me. And but again, it's I see a similar thing on the left toward Christians or toward so I think that it's a time when it seems that rationality has abandoned any kind of political discourse. But I think that gets back to what Oliver Donovan said to me in that email, that the intelligibility of politics and political authority is lost. It's no longer morally intelligible. So I think, I think it's a great idea to figure out how do you promote principled, reasonable conversation at the local church level, at the congregation level. And I don't know how, again, because of the fact that politics is something that people either don't talk about at all in church, or they talk about it purely in partisan terms, that unfortunately there aren't a lot of instances where that is happening, where people can set aside the question of who they're going to vote for, or who they think is going to do most damage to us, or who's going to make America great again, or whatever. And actually look at principle. It's unfortunate that that's the case. But I think one of the other things, let me say this last, I'm sorry.
We should really quit. One of the things that characterizes modernity is a displacement of reason by will. In other words, it's the loss of confidence that life can be lived in accordance with reason. And I don't mean just analytic reason, but that the world is intelligible, that God's that the world is meaningful, and that our lives are meaningful, and we can live with in accordance with a reasonable understanding of things. And the assertion of sheer willing, and I think this is why Nietzsche writes a book called The Will to Power, politics then becomes just a function of wills and competing wills, mm-hmm. not something that's engaged in the functioning of reason. But once you eliminate the link between truth and goodness, or the link between freedom and truth, once you say that people have to have freedom to discover the truth themselves, rather than say the truth shall make you free, then it's almost inevitable that sheer will and sheer passion and sheer desire comes to dominate political life. And that's a scary place to be. Thank you all so much for your time.
Just tomorrow's housekeeping issues, I mean, we have...